Hey, Zero Block 30 listeners, you can find us every Tuesday and Friday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Prime members can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Summer is all about the freedom to have fun. Forget a vacation and take a tequila-cation with new Truly Tequila Soda. This refreshing blend of real fruit juice from concentrate, sparkling water, and premium tequila blanco is the drink of the summer. Try all four refreshing flavors, all with 5% ABV and just 100 calories. Truly Tequila Soda. Keep it light. Hard Seltzer Beverage Company, Boston, Massachusetts. Please drink responsibly.
It's an anniversary edition for me of Zero Block 30. 10 years I'm celebrating with my beloved bride, and I'm glad to be spending part of that day with you all. I started the day with a big-time power move, went to Cracker Barrel, had a delicious spread of pancakes. The ham was a little salty, but everything else went down delicious. It's a lovely, lovely anniversary. I'll be spending the week at a nice little resort with my bride. And it feels good because after being in the military, 10 years, marriage is nothing to shake your fist at. It's a long time.
No.
It's a long fucking time.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Nice. Thank you. All right. Today's show, we got 5 rounds in the magazine. Round number 1, military ball season is fast approaching. And with that comes the dreaded fundraisers to the lower the ticket prices. We asked you what your units voluntold you to do. And the answers did not disappoint because, my friends, they are terrible and they are abundant. Round number 2, after 11 years with one of the worst looks in the military, sailors are not feeling blue about a big uniform change. They no longer have to wear those god-awful blueberry camouflage uniforms that look like complete bags of dicks. Round 3, cool? A slap in the base. Not cool? A slap in the face. We take you down to Coronado, California, where one Navy SEAL slapped another so hard, he put him in a motherfucking coma. And round number 4, we're going to talk to Brian Wood, MC. Now, you might be wondering what the MC stands for. It stands for Military Cross. It's one of the highest awards for valor from the United Kingdom. This gentleman's story is legitimately unbelievable. It's a story that I've been telling you about for the last couple weeks, or 2 weeks now, where I said that this story is going to blow your absolute dick or vagina off. It will not disappoint. Brian Wood, MC, what an incredible interview that was. Round number 5, a retired Army Lieutenant General and former superintendent of West Point is now the president at a known party school, the University of South Carolina, which is also the home of our beloved Kyle Carpenter. And this time, he's ready to fucking party. Just kidding. He wants you to get up early in the morning and PT with him. Are you going to do that if you're a student? And all of that is going to be brought to you by our good friends at Killcliff. Killcliff has changed the game in hydration. They have performance drinks that contain elite hydration benefits and are 100% all natural with a killer taste. The leading alternative to traditional sports drinks used by service members, Team USA athletes, world record holders, bloggers, podcasters, radio hosts, and soul crushers everywhere. They're sugar-free, they're keto-friendly, they're gluten-free, and they're the official partner of the Navy SEAL Foundation. Killcliff is fueling the American dream. Make sure you go get some of those by going to killcliff.com/ZBT. You're going to get a great deal. That great deal, what is it? Well, you're going to get 15% off and free shipping with the code ZEROBLOG at killcliff.com. That's 15% off with free shipping at killcliff.com with the promo code ZERO. And make sure that you know that they give a portion of all proceeds to the Navy SEAL Foundation. Let's start the show because it's going to be a big one. It's going to be delicious and you're going to love to slurp it down. Let's start it. I'm feeling spry. I'm feeling good. It's the first day that I've woke up in probably 6 months where I haven't had to like uncrust my eye with my fingers.
That's no great. That's today. Progress.
Yeah, yeah, I'm feeling good. I can actually read today too. Everything's clear.
Are you eyeing a return to rucking pretty soon then?
Yes, I will be back on the rucking game Tuesday. Will be my first day back. I have the anniversary weekend this weekend. I get back, I think, late Sunday night. And then I'll be back in the grind. We'll be recording on Monday, Tuesday morning, back on the grind working out. Can't wait.
All right, I'll keep an eye out for that.
Indeed.
All right. I like how you try. Collins is wanting to do an eye joke at the beginning. He's forcing it in there, even though I said I'm doing better.
I'm shoehorning it in there.
You
he's not
really
being
are.
A very good pupil, you know?
He's not. He's not. He's being right, kind of corny
with
it.
Do you want me to stop?
Yeah, his jokes are pretty cornea.
Want me to stop?
I don't. You stop whatever
just
you want.
Need to be
you
funny.
Keep it going if you need to.
Right.
All right. Hi, Gunny.
Let's get started with the show. Round number 1. What do we got, Catherine?
Guys, it is military ball season as we hit the fall. I know the big one for the Marine Corps is the biggest one of all, but I feel like across the branches, there's all sorts of events that happen in the fall. And fundraisers.
Yes.
That is when you get suckered in. They suck when you're a kid having to go around selling like the popcorn. I was a Girl Scout selling those cookies. It's just a pain in the ass.
Did you ever have to stand out in front of the supermarket and basically panhandle for money?
Yes, and it's the worst feeling in the world. And but who would have thunk?
The Girl Scout cookies sell themselves, though.
Yeah, at this point, very, very easily.
I just hated it. All I wanted to do was eat them. But basically, it's soul-crushing stuff, doing these fundraisers. And you never think you're going to get stuck doing it again as an adult, especially as a badass Marine or someone in the military. Not the case. Chaps, did you ever have to do fundraisers for your military balls to lower the ticket prices and stuff?
Oh, yeah. All the time. I mean, we did car washes when I was in Okinawa. We actually did one in Okinawa because we worked in the munitions area that was also had pineapple farms. They would legitimately, quote, farm us out to the pineapple farms to go cut the pineapples off the fucking bushes.
That sounds like it's actually kind of fun, though.
But I mean, it's like free labor. It's so not right. It's crazy.
It's not fun at all. Those things are prickly as hell.
Yeah.
We had to do
quite the experience. Maybe.
San Diego Bay, the speedboat races. They would have these cigarette boat races, and everybody would pull their cars and their RVs right up to the water's edge. They made us run in PT gear in the sand, in this like thick ass sand, with our Kevlars out, pandering to people for money to put money in our Kevlars.
They
made us do. 1, 2, 3, 4 They made us like do the chants as we're running along.
God.
It was fucking soul crushing.
It sounds terrible.
The other thing we had to do, which in hindsight, super shady. One of our higher ups was friends with a contractor who built barracks and stuff, who had like government contracts. On the weekends, there would be a white van outside our barracks at like 3:30 in the morning. You better be up in that van and driving out to 29 Palms from Camp Pendleton. So you could help. We had hard hats, the dust masks, and we'd be cleaning up construction sites of government contracted barracks.
That's wild to me. That is wild to me that they can make you guys go do that.
And you got like $10 off your ball ticket if you
did it. Everybody in the van knows that it's fucked up, but nobody can say anything.
Right.
Because
it's
like, do we suck it up and do this for 8 to 10 hours, or is Gunny going to be pissed at us for the next 6 months? Like, it's one or the other.
Right.
So we reached out on social media at ZeroBlog30. You can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and check out our YouTube, by the way.
By the way.
What?
I don't remember ever having to do any of this stuff.
Well, you're an officer, so you wouldn't know. But we reached out asking other people what common fundraisers were. And the most common answers we got were pulling security, concessions, garbage, and crowd control at pro sporting events. Our own social media guy, Kyle, at Son of a Gun with two N's, we would get rented out to do Chargers games at Qualcomm Stadium. That stadium's a dump hole, by the way.
Yeah, it is.
We'd stand by the seats and people would ask where their seats were, but we had no fucking clue. The Raiders-Chargers game was the worst. Had to buy our own uniforms and drive ourselves.
So
he had friends that verified this.
With this one, this is kind of crazy to me for the Chargers to rent out Marines to do this sort of thing. Granted, security and ushers helping people to get their seats, it's not brain surgery. But I have to imagine there's some sort of training or protocol that has to be followed, that you can't just have people coming in willy-nilly game day and have them do it effectively.
Oh, yeah.
By what he said.
One of Kyle's friends replied, some lady asked me where her seats were. I said, I have no idea. I don't work here. So she was shocked and looked at me and said, what do you do then? I quickly replied, I've been protecting America since 1775.
That's a great response.
That is a great answer.
Along a similar vein.
And he tweeted the picture of Gomer Pyle from Full Metal Jacket. Just staring into the distance.
Just dead inside. At Frenchyman3 said, got voluntold to work security at Lollapalooza in 2015. And this is, again, these are people doing this to just save a few bucks on ball tickets.
Right.
And they don't have a choice. So got voluntold to work security at Lollapalooza in 2015, checked fences outside the festival for 16 hours with a single 15-minute break. The unit supposedly got $50 per Marine. Oh, and we didn't get entry to the actual festival to see any performances.
Ah, oh, that's such a bummer.
This makes me laugh, because remember this year at Lollapalooza, all those kids stormed the fence?
Yes.
I wonder if there was any Marines standing by.
They were
like,
just like, yeah, go ahead.
Whatever. Trash Man at JP5811 said, picking up trash at a NASCAR track in Richmond, Virginia.
Yep. There- you know what? I guarantee you that was one of my Marines. Guarantee, because 5811 is the MOS code for MPs.
Yep.
Richmond, Virginia, he probably got sent down from Quantico. Guarantee it's from my old unit, because we established that when I was the company gunny, that going they would down go down to Richmond and clean up, or they would go up to FedEx and clean up the tailgating lots after it was over.
Help me understand this. Right. Where does the process start for this to happen, for someone to go to Richmond or to go up to one of these stadiums? Does someone reach out to your unit and say, hey, I need 100 bodies right damn now. What do you got for me?
Well, it's usually just like kind of the good old boy network where like you as a staff NCO or a young officer know somebody from a different unit, like an adjacent unit. Like, hey, how did you guys get this nice ass ball? How did you guys afford to go to the Gaylord in fucking Washington, D.C.?
Okay.
Like, oh, well, we got this hookup where on 3 game days a year, we would send all the Marines up and they would clean and they'd give us a big chunk. We put that to renting out the ballroom. And they're like, oh, shit. Do you have that dude's number?
So the officers are like sipping their caviar. They're like, excellent. Yeah, send them. Send those stupid
But the fucked up part is that you still, even if you're doing all that, the Marines are doing that. It's usually not the staff NCOs and officers that are doing it. And if you are, it's in a supervisory role that the junior Marines are still paying like 50, 60 bucks for their ball. Like,
right, which is
ball.
A lot. Which is a lot for someone at that rank.
Oh, yeah. And guys, I'm not done. I still got a couple more responses that made me laugh. At Rap Game Dakota Fanning said, great handle, forcing us all to get jobs working in the kitchens at the U.S. Open and then making us donate our paychecks from the 2 weeks of work to the ball fund. These fucking kids had to work for two weeks and then donate their Also, the course was like 3 hours from Lejeune, and we had to get our own transportation there and pay for our own food. And we couldn't drink the whole time. So they had to get themselves there, 3-hour trip.
Holy shit.
So 6-hour round trip, pay for their own gas, their own food, their own everything.
I'm surprised they wouldn't allow even any workers get a little complimentary meal working in the kitchen.
Here's the part that super sucks. As somebody who worked concessions down in Philadelphia before Barstool, the people that work concessions aren't doing it for fun. They need those fucking jobs.
Right.
So here we're taking jobs away from people who really need those hours. Anyways, at KCCO.
I have a question about that one.
Sure.
At Barstool, you know, we're a quote unquote normal company, right? And we have an expense system. The military doesn't have an expense system. Why don't they have an expense system? They clearly don't, but like why?
To pay for the balls and stuff?
Well, no, not even that. Like you have to pay for your own gas to get there for a 3-hour trip and back.
I got sent on a training trip. And because I used the wrong booking system, had to pay over $1,000
of
my own money. The whole system was insane.
So, Brandon, answer your question. We do have that, but it's very specific on what you can actually charge back to the government.
And oftentimes, the higher-ups don't even know how it works, so they don't tell the underlings how it works, so it's just kind of assumed. When you're at lower rank, you just like assume that's how things are, and you just pay for it yourself. Like, you don't know any better.
Yeah, we tried to game the system one time in school when we had to go to Fort Sill for training. So we're like, all right, instead of flying and letting them pay for flying, we'll drive our own vehicle, and then we'll recoup because you get X amount of dollars for all the miles. Someone did the math wrong, and we ended up having to pay out of pocket for going to training in the summer.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
At KCCO Fernie said, pulling security escort shit for the Chargers football games and the House of Blues. Instead of paying us, the money went straight to the ball. So most of us would take tips from people to let them into better sections.
I like that.
I have a take. I have a sports take. I bet the San Diego Chargers left San Diego just because they were tired of dealing with Marines.
Yeah.
They were like, we got to get the fuck out of San Diego.
Oh, yeah.
We need to have somebody else. We need to get some LA
people. The Marines are taking bribes to move people to better seats because they're so hard up for
gas. It was probably whenever they moved from Charger Stadium up to LA, they probably had Marines doing the working party.
Oh,
sure. Put the lockers in the back of the truck, Marines.
Yep, absolutely. At Old Breed Bubba 3 said, making us chip in for platoon parties. And then they would never have the platoon parties.
That's demoralizing. Like, hey, what happened to that platoon party? Oh, yeah, no, it's happening.
I have a couple more, but these are so good. I love reading them.
Let's just do one more.
This one I actually really like. Had rifle qual in the middle of August, and our first sergeant brought a grill and a cooler of cold drinks to the field and sold us hamburgers and drinks. Sold enough that the ticket prices for our ball actually went down.
See, and then, that's good.
Right.
That's a good one.
Last one. It's Mitchie said, I remember on two occasions that our first sergeant said, if you and your roommate pay $40, then you wouldn't have to field day that week, which is the full clean of your room. But your room inspection still needs to pass Friday. So yeah. Basically, like, pay $40 for zero reason at all. And the only
that's
other one was
inside the mind of leaders, too. Like, oh, yeah. You can't even let a room be dirty for a week.
Right.
Right.
Like, for a week.
It's just crazy. The only other one was a bid to pie senior leaders in the face. Was a good one. That was TBart17 said that. I like that one.
That one's fun.
Yeah. Pay money, get to hit your leader in the face with a pie. I can hear an old timer being like, I would, back of my cord, never do something like that.
I feel like I do remember something like that, seeing yeah. something like that when I was in the Army.
So
that's a good idea.
Yeah.
But just all of this, I didn't realize how prominent this was, that people would just be voluntold to do all these things for outside sources from the military, and then just this is basically a racket. This
oh my
is terrible.
God, for sure.
Such a racket.
Oh, whenever if you have like a legitimately good base general or something like that, high level base leadership, and they find out about this, they shut it down.
Oh, right.
Because
right.
you're not.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You can't make Marines work or soldier, sailor, airman, Marine. You can't make them 2 weeks in a kitchen.
Also, I'm
3 hours away from base. That's outside of liberty.
On their off day, no less.
The in the kitchen one blew me away too. Again, I love bragging the concessions lady. We had like there's food handling issues here.
Right.
There's like health concerns.
There needs to be training.
Right.
Like this isn't stuff you could just shove random people off the street into and have them expect to do a great job. It's just I don't know. This is just really, really crazy to me that this continues to happen.
All right, round number two, I'll set the scene, and just in case you don't know the uniform that we're talking about. So every other branch of service, whether it's the Army, the Air Force, or the Marine Corps and the Coast Guard, they have camouflage that looks pretty traditional. Like that, if you were going to a Dick's Sporting Goods or you're going to Gander Mountain or something like that, you have those colors. It's the very traditional olive drab, coyote, and black mixed together in some type of pattern, whether it be digital, whether it be tiger, whether it be striped, or whether it be multi-cam. You have different patterns. The Navy, for some reason, about a decade ago, thought it would be a good idea to stand out with their camouflage, which I think is defeats the purpose a little bit. When I first saw the Navy's blue camouflage uniform, it looks exactly like the Marine Corps, just with colors of blue. So there's a dark
like
blue, there's a lighter blue.
Blue.
Yeah, it's a bright, almost like a royal blue, and then they have like a almost a Carolina blue mixed in, and then black, and it's all a digital pattern. When I first saw it, I thought it was a joke.
So did I. Double takes. I remember them walking on base and being like, what the fuck is that?
I saw it was a corpsman. I was like, what? Where did you come from? I thought that, because you know, like if you go to the Arctic, you'll have the Arctic uniform that is primarily white camouflage, like Mark Wahlberg stands up in Shooter when he's wearing that uniform. I saw that and I was like, where the fuck were you where you were wearing blue? Like, they're like, well, it's a Navy uniform.
The only way these would blend in, because they don't even match the ships. They
no.
stand out against the ships.
Yeah, because
if you fell into the water. And there was a rumor that
if you are currently dying.
Yeah, is if you're in the water already fucked. The rumor was that if they hit salt water, the uniforms would turn like neon hunter orange, which is not true. But I believed that for years. I believed. I was like, I guess that's why they have them. I don't know.
But also, too.
That would be awesome, though. Because imagine if you, I mean, your sweat is salty. So, like, you're sitting there working a hard detail.
Neon orange pits.
Yeah.
That would not go well for me. But the other thing, too, like, why do you need to be camouflaged on a ship anyway? It's not like you're hiding those big ships, those big carriers. So I don't know why there was.
And the ships are gray. Like, have gray camouflage.
But no, but like even why do you need camouflage to even blend into a ship is my point. You're never going to – there's no ships that are so unassuming that you're going to miss it in the middle of the ocean.
Well, thankfully, their long national nightmare is over thanks to J.D. Simpkins over at the Navy Times, who let us all know that starting this past Tuesday, October 1st, sailors who are currently being forged by the sea will no longer have to blend in with it. After 11 perilous years of parading around looking like victims of an airplane toilet explosion,
great description.
The Navy finally is saying sayonara to the Type 1 Navy working uniform, a.k.a. blueberries, a heinous half-nylon boondoggle that not only wasted hundreds of millions of dollars, but endangered the lives of everyone who donned the accursed uniform.
Can we stop right there? I've got to give it to the Navy Times. Again, this is 2 weeks in a row. Incredible blogging here by the Navy
incredible
Times.
Incredible writing.
Yep.
This right? Like those descriptions, you tying in, I think, besides voluntold, one of the more military descriptive words of heinous. That wasn't an adjective that I heard describe anything until I got into the military.
Oh, yeah. This guy is great, J.D. Simpkins. And do you guys have any guesses why these blue uniforms? Because he says they endangered the lives of everyone. Why were they dangerous?
My guess would be, all right, if they fell in the water, we wouldn't be able to see them. But I don't think that's the actual reason.
No, it's because up until 2012, sailors didn't realize that a mere spark could turn them into blueberry flambé. That's right. These uniforms were highly flammable. Not great when you're dealing with, military weapons, metal ships that sparks can happen on. Who knows? As the Navy Clothing and Textile Research Facility put it after testing, it will burn robustly until completely consumed.
Just what you want to be wearing.
Not great. So they knew this. For almost 11 years, they knew that these uniforms were, like, super flammable, and it took until 2019 to finally fully switch over. But yes, once they figured out they were super flammable, it took about 3 years to start swapping out for what looks suspiciously now like Marine Corps digital woodland camis. Beginning in October 1st, 2017, sailors were given a full 2 years to purchase all new uniforms, and the Navy hiked up their annual clothing replacement allowances so they could purchase them. How many? They had 2 years. October 1st, 2017. Hey, you got 2 years to switch over to buy these new regular-ass looking uniforms. Who showed up October 2nd this week still in their fucking blueberries?
Would say a bunch.
You think?
Yeah, definitely.
I don't know.
I think that that's something that they would talk about a lot. Kate, did you ever? Because the Army, you wore the same uniform year round, right? Like you might roll sleeves or not roll sleeves.
Yes,
but no, the Marine Corps during the wintertime, we would wear woodland camis, and during the summertime we would wear desert camis to be a little bit cooler.
Sleeves down,
sleeves up, sleeves down. But whenever you used to switch from the woodlands to the deserts or vice versa, there's always that onesies or twosies that show up to work in the wrong uniform.
Oh, always fucked it up. Right. Yeah. Absolutely.
I never liked the digital pattern on any branch of service.
Oh, I love the Marine Corps one.
I thought it looked silly. I like the old woodland.
I thought y'all shit that you can fucking take the rank off with the Velcro would look ridiculous.
Yeah, that's insane. But the Navy, the new Navy ones look badass. They look super cool because they look like Marines. That's why.
What do they look like now? The new Navy ones.
Kind of like the Marine Corps woodlands. Okay. They're just a little more fuzzed out, I guess you would say. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they look pretty cool. But I do wish I could see. I know somewhere there was at least one. There was at least one who showed up to the line. You're looking across at everybody all lined up, and there's that one asshole in the blue still.
You know what I wish I could do now, going back? I wish I could grab a bunch of Marines who are wearing their little desert camis that are kind of like a creamy white tan color, and then get a couple corpsmen, sprinkle it in, be like, all right, give me 15 Marines, go form a circle. Now I need a couple corpsmen, go in the middle and make myself a little yogurt parfait.
Oh, yeah, just mix them up a little bit, swirl them around. Yeah. But I will say, too, I feel like every few years this happens where, like, the blueberries from the beginning, how the fuck do you not test and see if a uniform's flammable?
Yeah,
they're spending
pretty important.
Well,
hundreds of millions of dollars on these uniforms, and every branch fucks this up all the time. Where a couple years later, after they spend tens and tens of millions, they're like,
the Marine Corps were that way originally too. That's why whenever we first went, like, I think it was like the first 4 years after being in Iraq, like if you were in a Humvee, you had to switch over to a flight suit because the digital pattern camis that they made were too flammable.
Right.
Wow. I didn't know that. But my guess is that somewhere along the way, someone knew and they just didn't say anything because it would have costed too much money to fix the problem.
Or it would have made their higher up look bad. Yep. Or there would have been. So all these crazy ass, it happens all the time and it always blows my mind that it goes through so many people and still fuck it up. But hey, that's the military. It's our way.
No doubt about it. All right, let's move on to round number three.
Something else besides those Navy uniforms that was recently canceled is a little TV show. And no, not talking about NBC's The Code, rest in peace. We're talking about ABC's The Slap.
No, that was 2014, I'm pretty sure that was canceled. Are you sure?
Hold on, let me check my notes. Oh, you know what? I'm being informed that we're not talking about ABC's The Slap. We're talking about Navy SEALs The Slap.
Oh, I didn't know about that, what that was, but okay, go ahead, go on.
Right. Well, this one comes to us from the Navy Times as well, guys. They're crushing it this week. Big, heavy Navy week.
Mm-hmm.
This story is absolutely batshit crazy, by the way. The slap that nearly killed a prospective Navy SEAL happened at 10.09 a.m. on October 12, 2017, in the Donnell classroom inside California's Naval Amphibious Base Coronado, 24 minutes after Buds Class 326 handed out maps and compasses to students. Mm-hmm. So doing a little land nav. The instructor posted a land nav problem on the board, and the prospective Navy SEAL started figuring out an eight-digit grid solution. So we all remember land nav, sorting stuff. I sucked at it. I always fucked it up.
I always enjoyed it. I always thought it was fun.
And here it should be noted, as they're sitting in this classroom and they're trying to figure it out, Navy officials say challenge bets among SEAL students kept classes fun and foster a competitive camaraderie. So if you get a wrong answer, instructors would sometimes make students drink dip spit, get their heads shaved, or forgo food until they left for training sometimes. So slightly harsher than your usual punishments. Mm-hmm. But the go-to bet in this particular classroom that day was a slap. So back to that land nav problem they're all trying to figure out. A 19-year-old student challenged a classmate who sat in front of him to deliver the right eight-digit grid square. Mm-hmm. And the challenged student fucked it up. He got it wrong. So while the other students continued their work, the pair strolled to the front of the classroom and mounted a small stage. The challenger stood a yard apart and cocked back an open palm. The other student put his hands behind his back, waiting for the slap. Waiting for that.
Like a good boy. Like if you're doing a slap game, you got to go hands behind your back.
Hands behind your back. Wait for that slap. Just shut your eyes and wait. It was a good slap, the instructor told investigators. I guess he caught him right on the button. That's right, because the slapped student stumbled. The sound of his head smacking the tiles of concrete echoed through the classroom enough to get everyone's attention. And the student's skull struck the stage with enough force that it made an audible noise. Oof. At first, he was completely passed out. People started running for medical help. At first, he seemed to respond to a sternum rub, but blood began pooling around him on the deck. By the time medical personnel arrived, he'd awakened but was combative and disoriented, and they had to pin his arms and get him into a backboard.
So let's just be clear. It wasn't the slap that made him start bleeding from the ear. He was stumbling around, and it reads like he fell and smacked his head.
Well, they think the slap was so fucking hard, it like knocked him out.
Maybe knocked his equilibrium off?
Right. So the senior medical official at the scene later told investigators she couldn't get a straight answer from the instructor. At first, he told her the guy was just talking and fell. but then that segued into something they were just horsing around. First responders rushed the slapped student to an ER in San Diego, where they discovered he had a skull fracture.
Jesus Christ.
And blood had oozed into the membrane between his bone and brain.
Very serious.
He was placed in a medically induced coma to control pressure caused by swelling of the brain tissue, which was pushing against his skull, threatening to suffocate his brain. The 29-year-old patient emerged from the coma 2 days later, but could not remember the slap or anything about that day or the day before or the day before.
Wow.
It remains unclear whether the patient is still in the Navy or if it left him with permanent injuries. We don't know that yet. But apparently the guy had no ill will for the guy who slapped him, said, we were just training to become hard men. Do you think that's part of training to become hard men?
No, I don't. No? And that's somewhere else.
I mean, let's back up. Because you don't think that a slap, I bet that this has been done in SEAL school for fucking ever.
Oh, yeah.
It's
so,
one time that something comes out. And it is a freak accident, like he tripped, hit himself the wrong way.
Yeah.
I don't think this is where, like, we look at one incident, and obviously this is a horrific thing for somebody to be hospitalized and have blood coming out their ears and probably have, like, a brain injury that's going to last them the rest of their life. But that's been part of, like, SEAL and tough culture for fucking ever. I mean, Collins, you've said that you've had the type of bet going with your soldiers where you got slapped.
No. We did slap bets in Iraq. We didn't do them on the face, though. We did them against the chest. My problem was, I agree. This has probably been, it's been going on for a very long time. I don't have a problem with doing stuff like this. What I kind of took umbrage, though, in the article is the guy said it toughens people up. I don't think slap bets make you tough.
No.
Also, if you need slap bets to toughen you up, I don't think you belong in one of our elite training schools, right? You should be tough going into that. I don't think slap bets toughen you up. I think it brings you together, as it said. It develops camaraderie. I don't think that makes you tough. I think you are...
Drinking dip spit does, though.
That's just disgusting. Right.
And I don't think that that's what they're saying. I don't think that they're saying that this guy was a pussy, so he had to do
I'm reading the article, and Kate didn't mention the part that I read yesterday, but the article said we one of the reasons we do slap bets and these challenge bets is to toughen people up. And I just don't think that's the right answer. I think most of these guys going in to SEAL training, to BUDS, to Army Rangers, to Air Force pararescues, you're already inherently tough. And these schools will teach you a little bit more about mental toughness and help you develop your resiliency. I don't think slap beds do that. I think that's just part of the culture.
Is because you do have to sit. There's like a lot of physical training to like SEAL, but there's also a lot of sitting in classrooms forever doing stuff like this.
It makes it fun. Yes, I agree.
That's more what it is, and it kind of motivates you to not get it wrong because you don't want to get slapped in the fucking face. Like
I used to love it, dude. When we would do like in-service training, whenever we'd have different types of training, and one of the black belt instructor trainers were like, okay, you drop your blouses. You guys are going to go outside and you're going to roll for 3 minutes at a time. And so we would go outside. We would take off our tops and the circle of Marines would like circle around you and you legitimate grapple for 3 minutes. And that broke up the monotony of the day, like where you're still and you're used to getting in a physical confrontation because you could be as tough as you want. But I don't think that people, just because they're a SEAL or they're a Ranger or they're a Marine or they're airman, whoever, means that you've been in physical confrontations. You could be also tough never been in a physical confrontation in your life. So exposing you to actually taking a punch or exposing you to actually somebody's trying to choke you out, actively trying to choke you out, and you getting out of it, I think there is some benefit whenever you're in a tough, rough environment.
No, you're right. No, you're right. And those things, you do need to know what that feels like to roll around or to take a punch. The only thing I'm saying with this, and I don't have a problem with doing slap bets, all I'm saying is don't piss on my leg and tell me it's raining, okay? Don't tell me it's too toughen them up. Tell me it's because of what you just mentioned, Chaps. Tell me it's because it develops camaraderie. I just don't like the thing that slap bets make you tough because I don't think that's what they do.
I think it's I just feel like it's overall just a shame this guy.
It's such a freak accident.
Top of his thing, and it's a shame that he lost it because that's fucking dumb. Take him outside to grapple. Yeah. That, to me, is safer than this. Like, that's got fucking SEALs.
But I would. I mean, if you ask me, like, before it started, like, if you ask anybody, because they've done it hundreds of thousands of times, I would imagine, at SEAL school, like, you're going to get slapped in the face. And, like, to get knocked out with a slap, it has to be somebody, like, one of those Russian mitts, like, that comes at you.
Yes.
Or just an unbelievably hard slap. Or I just perfectly placed.
Later down the line, this guy being like, I was almost a Navy SEAL, dropped out. Well, what happened? Got slapped, man.
Yeah,
like, how do you tell
that
people?
That definitely sucks. It definitely sucks, dude.
I mean, you do a lot of times end up, especially now, you do make rules like that prohibit things like that because of the one time freak accident that something can happen. That's just the nature.
Because you're right. Because how many slaps before this guy got hurt happened?
Well, slap bets are forbidden by regulations there.
I'm sure drinking dip spit is too.
Drinking dip spit and withholding food, and that probably also is as well. And the instructors are supposed to make sure stuff like that doesn't get out of hand if they're doing it, obviously. But the Navy is saying this is a rogue SEAL instructor who lets students get out of hand. So who knows?
I bet the guy who slapped just feels like shit, man.
Oh, yeah. Like, for sure. For
19 sure. years old, you're in SEAL training, you're amped the fuck up, you're going up there and you don't want to slap softly, so you go too far, and next thing you know, somebody's in the hospital. I bet he feels like fucking shit, man.
He feels great, but I did. I can understand how the other guy who got slapped said, "I don't harbor any ill will towards that
guy." Yeah, I wouldn't.
He was just doing what we've always been doing in SEAL training.
Well, when you put your hands behind your back, you're just goofing. Like, it's a goof slap, and next thing you know, something bad, terrible happens. All right, let's move on to round number four. Round number four, this is the interview that I have been waiting for you to hear for a long time. This is Brian Wood, MC, a former Army British soldier. Here's his story. Now on the show, I'm privileged to have, I just finished up his book and it was unbelievable. We have Brian Wood, MC, joining us all the way from the UK. Brian, thanks for joining us on the show.
No, thanks for having me. Real pleasure.
So, no, when you were 22 years old, you're a young man. You joined even younger than that, right? 17? Is that when you joined?
16 in 9 months.
That's so crazy that you guys can join so young. Is whenever you were like a little boy, is that something that you always wanted to do was to join the military?
I'm from a really heavily military family, if I'm honest. But it was I was destined to be a football player. I was with Chelsea Football Club, which is a very big mm-hmm. premier football team in the UK. And but for a number of different reasons, travelling was a real demand because my dad was serving at that point and we just couldn't make training. So I left Chelsea, but then was picked up by Reading Football Club, which are a professional football club. And I just never filled out physically what they wanted. So they cut me. They just decided to let me go. And my sort of knee-jerk reaction was, I want to do what my brother and my dad are doing, and that's serving and fighting for their country, and it's something that I want to do. And I felt a little bit left out as well around the dinner table. They were having these incredible conversations where I didn't understand, but I wanted to be involved in them conversations. And I just, yeah, I turned around one day and said, look, I'm going to go and join the military.
And what year was that? That was 1998, right?
Yeah.
Wow. So not a whole lot is really going on in the world in 1998 military. September 11th happens. The UK, being our strongest allies, get involved with the war with us. At that time, you were how old? You were about 20 at that point?
Yeah. Yeah. 20. Yeah, I was 20. Yeah.
So are you thinking everything is going to change for you whenever that goes down?
Well, I was actually representing the British Army football team in Aldershot, where our headquarters is. And I was in the showers at the time when the first tower was hit, and someone come running into the showers and said, hey, listen, one of the twin towers has been hit. And I was like, what? So I got dried, got changed and went in. And we all, as a football team, was watching it live. And I phoned my wife up and told her what was happening. And there was some chat around the guys who were in that room because we were all serving. And we all knew now the dynamics have shifted and we're going to go war fighting. We knew that. Especially me as an infantry soldier, I knew, you know, that we were going to be punching the ground.
And I also, like, I want to point out to our listeners that you were 20 years old and you went and told your wife. So it's not just the U.S. military thing where soldiers get married really young. It's a British thing as well. I think that's great. So we constantly say that people get married in the military young for TRICARE and for love and for all these reasons. But for some reason, I think it's a universal thing that soldiers get married young.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, my brother got married quite young, and my dad got married very young, and my mum and dad are still together, stronger now than ever. So, yeah, hopefully, you know, I can take a leaf out of their book and continue my relationship with my wife. I mean, it hasn't all been easy. There's been a lot of demand on my relationship, especially coming back. And then I know we'll talk about the allegations that were made, but that really put a lot of pressure on our relationship. And
let's jump into your story so we can kind of set up those trials and tribulations that you went through. Tell us about the Battle of Danny Boy.
Yeah, so this is my first tour of Iraq, and it was 2004. And before during our pre-deployment training, we were getting some intel fed down that things had changed, the dynamics have shifted from peacekeeping. Muqtada al-Sadr, who was the main militia leader within our province, and basically dropped the ceasefire and said that all coalition forces are going to get smashed. And the last 3 weeks, this tempo became pretty violent and really kinetic. So mentally, we were ready for anything, really, because we were always training as a worst course, because we do in the military. And when we flew in to Basra, we then kind of done a 2-week acclimatization period in Basra. And then there was a lot of casualties coming down from Al Amara, from the light infantry who we were taking over. So we knew it was serious, and we knew it was punchy up there because of everything that we were getting told and the casualties that we were actually seeing come back. And I remember, flying into country up north, knew Al Amara was pretty crazy at this time. And yeah, it was kind of the craziest handover takeover that I've ever been involved in, because normally, as you know, when you go into areas, it's done in I would say, slowish time that you know you get told by the other commanders where the vulnerable points are, the vulnerable areas, what's happening, the pattern of life. Mm-hmm. There was none of this. We were like fighting, integrated. So our first patrol, we got in, sort of, you know, dropped our bags and stuff off, sorted ourselves out. Then we went on our first sort of mixed patrol, ready to do the handover. And I was fighting with people who I never knew. Like this is a different regiment, but they all understand our training practices. We're all doctrinally understand what we're doing tactically. So it was kind of, I knew, but you know, different organizations have different sweet spots. They have
right, you know, and different responsibilities. If you're going to go in, like you have the same terminology, but somebody can do it just a little bit different than you do. And whenever you're actually out real world mission, you get the call to do this. You're kind of worried, like, I know that he should technically be on my left. Is he going to be in the exact position that I think he's going to be in?
Yeah.
Are we a little bit different, a little bit off?
Yeah. So that, and that's exactly that. And, but we just kind of had to roll with it. We had no other choices. We just had to fight and fight hard with, you know, other members of different regiments, but we did that. And that tour continued to be like full on. I think we lost 14% casualties within the first 2.5 weeks that we were there. So we were getting hit hard, and you know, people were you know, becoming casualties quite often and frequent. And the Battle of Danny Boy started actually, it was the 14th of May 2004, and it was around about 14:30 hours, and I was out on a vehicle checkpoint, and it was blistering heat. Mm-hmm. And I was told by my vehicle commander, let's stop what I'm doing. So collapse the vehicle checkpoint and get the men under my command. So I was a lance corporal at this time at 23, to stop what I was doing and get back into our armored fighting vehicle, because we're in these Warriors, which are an infantry armored fighting vehicle. So we mounted up into the vehicle. I put on the headset, the internal comms, to speak to my commander, and he said, look, there's been an incident. Two British soldiers have been hit in an ambush, and they are pretty serious casualties. One's potentially going to bleed out, so we are kind of now on a rescue mission. Mm-hmm. And we started to go down Route 6, and Route 6 is a
and
really
how many long- are with you in the vehicle? How many are under your command in the vehicle?
Me plus two. Because
okay.
We were struggling for manpower at that point as well. I mean, we were spread because we had lost a lot. We weren't getting our battlefield casualty replacements quick enough. So we were thin on the ground. I mean, yeah, me plus two in the back, which normally carries eight. So, yeah, really thin. And these guys...
And that's scary as fuck by itself, just being out with just three people in an area like that. It's already like you're... apprehensive, because if something goes down, you just got you three. That's fucking scary just on its own.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know, and I think it was like 2.5 to 3 weeks prior to Danny Boy, I was hit hard, and two AT-4 Soviet Union missiles come straight through our vehicle and caused all sorts of damage in the back. And that gave you
a pretty severe concussion whenever that happened, right?
I mean, yeah, my hair was all burnt off. I was riddled with shrapnel. The guy who was opposite me, a New Zealand lad, he had his nose kind of ripped off. And Irvin, the other guy, the LMG Minimi gunner, had like really bad shrapnel damage to his leg, and he was like losing a lot of blood. And then the vehicle started to fill up with diesel because it hit the diesel tank, which is in the back. So I started to feel wet feet, and I thought it was blood initially, but it was diesel filling up. But the scariest thing for that was our armor was now penetrable, and that's what scared me. So I knew that we weren't invincible in the back of these armored vehicles, because things can get through, because hence 2.5 weeks prior to that.
It's already happened to you. Yeah.
It's already happened, and we took a lot of casualties. And actually, Johnson Bihari Victoria Cross was the driver of my vehicle, who then, you know, after many of his actions, he then went on to be awarded the Victoria Cross.
And you know, so for our American listeners that might not know, because we have a lot of civilians too, Victoria Cross is the equivalent of the Medal of Honor. It's the highest award for valor that England has.
So he saved my life. And then many months later, I actually saved his life. I dragged him out of a vehicle that he had been hit not too far away from an RPG, a direct hit, and it kind of, oh, he was in a bad way. But me plus one other guy, I mean, it was just pretty crazy, actually. It was the whole town was lit up. It was full-on war fighting. And I got out of the vehicle and pulled him out. But I'm digressing anyway, because we want to talk about, you know, the Battle of Danny Boy. So going back to that 14th of May, we were in a vehicle. We were going down Route 6, which was a main supply route from Basra to Baghdad. And it's a very vulnerable route because it's only one way in and one way out. So we knew it's kind of, you know, it's a risky road to be on. But we had our main effort to go and extract these two soldiers who were injured. And I reckon maybe at 15 minutes into the journey, we got hit. And I've been, by this point, I've been hit pretty hard by all sorts of rooftop militia, you know, from the windows, from the doorways, from the alleyways. This was different. This was overwhelming, just super violent. I knew it was different because we came to a grinding halt and the armoured vehicle, which is 33 tonne, was shaking all over the place with the amount of ammunition that was it was getting hit by. And you know, being in the back of that vehicle, knowing what happened to me two and a half weeks prior, I had all sorts of emotion. And I think the biggest being fear, but I also know that fear is very contagious and I had to get a grip of it because I was a leader and a commander still at a young age at 23. So I really had to kind of acknowledge the fear because it's, you know, you should do that. But also control it's a big thing, and don't let it overwhelm you because, like I said, it's contagious, and you know you've got soldiers looking at you to make some big decisions.
And I think that's a perfect spot. My favorite quote about courage is not the absence of fear, but moving forward despite fear. And I think that's a perfect illustration. And to people who I've talked to, plenty of military folks who said, "Oh, I wasn't scared of this or that." Shut the fuck up. Yes, you were. Like, you were scared, and it's okay to admit it. I think that's how we move forward and have these guttural reaction, do what's needed. Because if you don't have that fear that you're about to lose your life, it could cripple you, like legitimately cripple you.
100% agree with that. Totally agree with that. And when I do quite a lot of speaking engagements, and I say, you know, people who turn around and say, yeah, they're not scared, is just like, yeah, they're just full of shit. And
there's something drastically wrong with you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you are, you know, when you are fighting for your life, you will do everything to survive that, and your body goes through all sorts of emotions. And I was no different. I was in this vehicle. It was getting hit hard. The gunner and commander were doing their thing. They were trying to identify where the stronghold was. They did that. They started to return fire. And we've got 30 millimeter Radon on our vehicles and 7.62 chain guns. So there's a lot of noise going off, and you know, it was a two-way engagement now. But I knew not to get down my commander's throat straight away on the radio, because I've got to allow him his time appreciation for him to do his thing, because I knew that everyone else was going to be on the radio asking for a sit rep, asking for updates on what's going on. So I left him.
And it now, I've heard you tell that story before. Do you think that if you hadn't been in all those other firefights at that moment, if that was your first real deep being taken charge, that you would have fucked that up and things could have went drastically different? If you would have known to not be quiet and let things kind of develop?
No, I think we're educated on that a lot. You know, we've got to, we call it a cigar moment, a pause, 2-3, chill, allow the situation to kind of happen. And then we can then dictate that situation. So I call it a cigar breather moment, that he is now engaged in a firefight. I can't see what's going on because I'm in the back of this armored vehicle. It's boiling point in there. There's no aircon. There's no cold water. There's only a small window on the back door, but with grit and condensation, you can't see fuck all out of it. So you've just got to do your moment. Allow that to happen. I knew that there was an engagement happening. And then when there was a moment, I then asked him, "Stick, what's happening?" He said, "Listen, Woody, there's a stronghold. 10 to 15 militia fighter are dug in. They're dug in trenches." And I was like, "That's different." Straight away, because normally we're in the city fighting,
right?
And I said, "Okay." And he said, "Listen, we're still engaging, wait out." So he basically told me to wait, And then I then told the boys in the back, because they can't hear what's going on because it's only me who has the headset on.
Mm-hmm.
So I relayed the information to the guys in the back and said, look, this is happening. And they were like, okay, cool, no problem. And then a few minutes later, he was like, Woody, prepare you and your men to dismount this vehicle and go and launch a counterattack on that stronghold. And I was like, fucking hell, that's a punchy command.
Jesus and I was Christ.
Like, yeah, I was like, shit, you know, there's only three of us. But
that's a punchy command. What a way to phrase it. God.
Yeah, I mean, it was, yeah. So I was like, right, okay, roger that. Then I needed to ask some questions. So I said, look, what's their weapon variants? And it was AK-47s, PKMs, a traditional Middle Eastern right. weaponry, RPGs, to name but a few. I started to kind of do my deductions on that. We had our armored fighting vehicle. Yes, we were outnumbered, but we were professional soldiers, and I like to think we were a lot better than our enemies. So we had a chance. I mean, we had to believe that, and as a commander, I did believe that we would have a chance. And I said to him, I said, right, Stick, the boys have been briefed, and what I would like to do is get out of the vehicle and go and try and go into some cover. So at least I won't be going out disorientated and blind, because I never knew where the enemy were, because I was in the back of this vehicle. I knew I was going to be like, it was going to be a demand for me when I got out, and the bright lights of, you know, of the sun and the desert, it was going to be hard for me to adjust. So I wanted to go to a position where I could then do my own estimate and have my own visual of that trench and where it is and what I then think I could do at that point. So he said, right, there is. When the door opens to the to 11 o'clock of this door, there's like a dried out irrigation ditch. That will give you cover from view and fire, and then you can make an estimate from there. We'll give you a rapid fire
mm-hmm.
and give you enough time to get the enemy's head down for you to get out and get into there. And I was like, right, boys, we're good to go. Stand by. And by example, I was going to go first and leave that armored our armored vehicle.
Because now, was that a cognitive decision or an instinctual decision for you to be first out?
I think I've got a responsibility to lead my men by example. I've always been brought up that way, and you know, tactically we can argue tactics all day long, because there is no clear definition of how other people would have done different. And if someone had done it different, maybe they wouldn't be here today. So I've done something right, and I chose to go first. I chose to inspire my men and lead them, you know, by example. And I believed in that. And I said to them, look, we're good to go. You give me a mini H hour. So it was like 5, 4, and then the door starts to open, because it's on a hydraulic system. So when that door opens, it's pretty rapid, but it's such a heavy door, you have to rely on the hydraulics. And that door went open, and I remember blinking into like the flickering of pure light. And I was like, what? And then put my boots on the desert floor and looked up, and I seen exactly where I needed to be. And I just ran hard, fast and aggressive to this dried out irrigation ditch and dived down in prone position, looked to my left and seen the bravest of other two lads following me, big Fijian lad and Rushy. They come in. We had a bit of a laugh in that, because it's a nervous laugh. You know what it's like when you're in them wild.
Like, I can't believe we're fucking doing this right
yeah,
now.
Yeah. And I was like, holy shit, can you hear this? And I mean, it was going off at this point. It was flat out. So I was like, fucking hell, right, let's have a little check. So we checked ourselves to make sure none of us were hit, because the adrenaline, I mean, I say to a lot of people, it's hard to describe. I call it an out-of-body experience, this adrenaline, because it's a drug like no other. It's an endorphin like I've never experienced before. You know, if I'd been hit, and this has been proven many a times, that many soldiers do get hit but don't realize in the moment mm-hmm. because they are so overwhelmed by this adrenaline that it's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
And we checked ourselves. We there was no blood, and we were good to go. And I said, well, I need to go and have a look where this position was. And I remember crawling up, peering over this like bun line where we were in this ditch. And I was like, fucking hell, That's a big shout. 120 meters away, you know, trench warfare now. It's going to be like full-on CQB, close quarter battles. And I was like, fuck, this is going to be wild. But I had to maintain belief, really. So I said to the boys, you know, I've seen this. There's a lot of them.
Was the 15 number accurate?
It was 28.
Jesus Christ.
So 20 were killed and 8 were taken as, 9 were taken as POW, 29. So it was a big attack, a big pre-planned attack on us. And I kind of was doing my thing. And then randomly, out of like nowhere, another 2 soldiers joined us. And there was another commander who was a more senior commander than what I was. And another just a normal private soldier had joined. So there was now 5 of us, which honestly gives me a massive boost. Because now it's like a section. It's a section attack. You know, we've got a section and we've got fire support from our armored vehicles, which now we had 2 warrior fighting vehicles really punching a lot of ammunition into them, that trench system. So all of a sudden, we are fully in the game now. I mean, I never have gone there and say to the lads that we haven't got a chance. I was always upbeat. I always believed and we could achieve the unachievable. Because a lot of people even now think how and what you achieved was kind of unachievable, but you did it. It's like mad, really. So the other commander, he did his thing. He did his evaluation. And then we agreed that we're going to move as 2 teams. Me and my men, and then him plus 1, because we were different platoons, but obviously the same company.
Mm-hmm.
So I just said to him, "Right, we're good to go. We're going to go straight down the middle. We weren't going to go right flanking because we never knew what was out in the flank. We weren't going to go left flanking because we were too close to our armored vehicles, and you know, blue on blue was a big thing. So we was like, we're not going to risk it, and we're just going to go straight up the middle, straight down the killing area, and just let's have it." And he's like, "Right, happy days." And I said to the boys, "Right, stand by. We're off and we're going to go." And fucking, yeah, we just got up and started
were you still out of body where you're like, "I can't believe I'm doing this"? And I know it's hard to, like, this many years now to kind of look back and remember exactly what it was like. But I can see, like, even when we're talking, like, you're looking off to the right or looking off to the left, and it's almost like you can still picture it very vividly in your head, because I'm sure it's something that you've replayed thousands of times. Do you think of it as, like, when you're looking at it, are you looking at it through your eyes or above, like, watching yourself do it from above?
I'm there.
Yeah.
I feel it. I smell it, you know. I can... Yeah, I know exactly how I felt. The adrenaline that I was going through, the look on the other lads' faces, and it's just the heat, everything about that day, the noise. The noise was horrendous, like so loud, and it was just like, stand by, we're going. It was like going over the top, Second World War type stuff. It really was, and it was me plus my other 2 guys went up, bounded forward, and straight away, as soon as we went up and kind of exposed ourselves, that was it. It was a 2-way range. And when I say, like they say, effective enemy fire is when rounds are landing in and around your feet or you're taking casualties. And we were fucking ineffective enemy fire at this point. It was like fucking the bees were buzzing all over you.
Yeah.
And it was in and around your feet. And I was thinking, how the fuck are we not even taking a casualty yet? Just move. And then the other 2 guys and bounded forward, leapfrogged us, engaged. We started then getting closer and closer and closer. And like 50 yards away. Then all of a sudden, we're 70 yards away. And now I can start to see some of the militia fighter leave. They started to withdraw. So I knew that we had the upper hand.
That probably gives you like a fuck yes, let's go. Yeah.
We were good to go. We were like, keep the aggression.
Yeah.
Keep the battle rhythm, you know, and we just keep punching forward. And we were getting close and I could now start to hear them communicate. There was a lot of them moving around in this position. And we were just about to go in and kind of clear it. And the kind of last down position that we were in, we have a word of command, and it's called pairs, pairs, pairs. And you just go and you break down into pairs, and you just go straight in and roll everything up and clear everything that's in your way. And all of a sudden, as pairs, pairs, pairs were just about to be commanded, they threw their weapons down like and surrendered. And, you know, when, and I say this to, and I've said it in many of the press releases that I've done and some of the interviews on TV that I've done, when you're fighting for your life, you do anything to survive. You're in survival mode. And when you have to make a split second decision under so, well, extreme circumstances, sometimes we get it wrong. But in this case, in this instance, we actually never got it wrong. It was, we cease fire, stop fire, and switch fire. And now,
that is, I can't even imagine.
It was carnage, if I'm honest. They said in the newspapers it was textbook. Fucking, it was no textbook about it. It was a lot of confusion. There was a lot of, like, trauma all over the place. Now, like, there was militia fighters in half. There was body parts. There was, you name it, I've seen it. And I was, like, 23 as well. Like, I've just stopped on this main trench position trying to figure out what to do, if I'm honest, because there was weaponry everywhere. There was militia who were alive, so I was trying to segregate the dead from the alive, and weapons everywhere, and trying to get the weapons off them to unload and make safe, because I was really worried that they were going to grab a weapon and have an opportunity and spray us. So I had all this going through my head, and then death, another position, started firing at us. So now we've gone into the trench with them. So we are, like, fully on, arms distance away in the trench with these militia fighters, and with, like, loads of dead bodies everywhere. It's like, this is pretty carnage. I try to take a pause, like a little cigar moment, sort it out, and we managed to kind of take control of the situation. We done what we had with, like, the shemags we put around their eyes just so they couldn't see, and it was kind of the element of surprise, you know, that's what we were going through. And we're going through, like, the POW stage where you disarm, disorientate, and maintain the shock of capture. So that's what we were doing at this point. And then I remember just, like, once the control of that was done in this main position, I remember my sergeant major turned up and was like, Woody, fucking hell, what's going on here? And I was like, fucking, I don't know, but I couldn't even remember really, because I was just in the daze. And he said, look, is the battlefield clear? And I really wanted to say at this point it was, not because I was a coward, it's because I was lucky to be alive and I didn't want to go through the same again. But because of my integrity and my values and what I stand for as a soldier, I was like, sir, it's not clear. I saw militia fighters fall back. There's pockets of enemy another 100 metres beyond this position. And he's like, right, okay, put a fresh magazine on. You and I are going to go and do a clearance patrol. And I was like, ah, fucking hell. But to be honest, if I was going to go and do a clearance patrol, it was with my sergeant major, because he was one of the most inspirational legends and leaders of men I have ever worked with. What a guy. And he was by example. And we went up, we started pepper potting, probably got 50 metres, 80 metres, and then I saw a movement on the right-hand side, and a militia fighter stood up with his AK-47. I shouted, target right. And before I even got right out of my mouth, my sergeant major was all over him. You know, put a number of rounds into his midriff and dropped him. Target down, eliminated, move. And then I moved forward, and militia fighter sort of come out of an irrigation, but with his RPG on, just about to fire an RPG off at us. And I just, like, put a number of rounds into his chest cavity and also a couple of into his throat. And I remember, because it was so close, this was like 10 meters away from me.
Jesus
Christ. I remember him choking and the noise that he was making to try and gain breath. But I didn't have any time to think. I just bounded forward. And I said to my sergeant major, look, sir, we're really vulnerable because there's so many of British soldiers now on the real position where the main trench position was. We should be going back there because we've got a lot of cover there. And he said, yeah, you're right. So I then started to fall back with my sergeant major, and I saw from, like, this corner of my eye movement, and I looked and I brung my weapon up to bear, and it was two more militia fighters stood up, And I was like, just about to engage, and they threw their weapon systems down, and that was it. We had to go in and go through the whole arrest and restraint and take them as POWs. We took them back to the main position, and that was the first time that I'd sat down and drunk some water. So I talked through that kind of battle in about 20 minutes, but it actually took us about 3 hours from start to finish. Yeah. It was punchy. Yeah, it was a long day. And I sat down, I started drinking some water, and the sergeant major come up to me and said, "Woody, we need to get prepared to go and collect these dead bodies and load them up into the vehicles." And I was like, "What? That can't be right." I knew that call was fucked up. Yeah. I knew it was crazy, because normally we allow them dead in situ because by Muslim law, they have to be buried in 48 hours. So I was like, why are we taking these back? That's messy. You know, like, taking another human's life, regardless of their enemy forces, is a demand anyway, especially from such close quarters. To then go back and lift the person's body up that you've taken, it was fucking crazy, if I'm honest. It wasn't good. But we done it. We had to do it. So we spent the next kind of 40 minutes lifting these bodies or putting.
And you're already exhausted too. Like physical and emotional toll that takes on you. And then have to go and put, legitimately dead weight onto a vehicle. Yeah. I don't know how you guys did that, physically.
No, it was hard. I think, especially when you're up and down with emotion and adrenaline as well. One minute you're up, one minute you're down, and it's like, oh. But we did this, right? And we load them onto the vehicles. It was a demanding task, and something that really played on my on my headspace as well later on in life. Mm-hmm. I couldn't shake a lot of the things that I'd smelt and seen, and it was playing havoc with my headspace. But at that point, we did it. A good friend of mine was like being violently sick next to me, and I was like, right, you just sit there and you just kind of get some fluids on. We need to get these bodies sorted out. And they were in a fucking bad way, because they were, you can only imagine what 30 millimeter does to your body. Your pink mist, you're all over the place. So we were kind of having to do this anyway. We loaded them onto the vehicles and went back to our fob, which was Abenaki. And by the time we got back there, there was so much commotion. Everyone was waiting for us to get back. And we got back to the camp. I dismounted from the vehicle that I was in. And then my regimental sergeant major was at the gates waiting for us. And he said, "Look, Woody, you need to go and take the bodies, the vehicles, up to the regimental aid post. The doctor's going to be there waiting for you to unload them." So I said, "Yeah, okay, no worries, roger that." Took them up to the regimental aid post. The doctor was there. The body bags were laid out. And he said, "Right, get the doors open. We'll start unloading the bodies." And I said to him, "Look, these are in a pretty bad way. You can smell it from outside the armored vehicle, feces, man fat, clots of blood that I've never even believed that could be in a human being. I mean, these were like horrendous." And he's like, "I get it. Let's get this door open." And remember I said about the doors being on a hydraulic system. Mm-hmm. So I said to one of the boys, "Right, get the door open." And he's gone to press the button. Nothing. Dead. And I was like, I can't even believe this day is just about to get even worse than what it already is. So what that meant was someone had to climb through the turret, go into the back and climb over these bodies and open it manually. So we played paper, scissors, stones to see who would do that. And my driver lost. And he put his shemagh on his nose and... he said, "Look, can you talk me through, reassure me when I'm climbing through the back?" And I was like, "Yeah, of course I will." So we were talking to him, reassuring him, and it was just a horrible thing. So we started manually doing it, and it takes a while to hand crank it open. And he must have got it to the, maybe you can squeeze out of the door sideways, where I heard loads of screaming. And I was like, "What's happening now?" So, and he's left the vehicle and sprinted past me shouting, "He's alive, he's alive." And I was like, "What?" So I've looked in the back of the vehicle, and due to the nature of his wounds, he wasn't alive. But what he was set up bolt right with his eyes open. So it must have freaked him out in the back. And he come running past, and it was just a nightmare. But that event, that single event alone, ruined his life through trauma and mental health. He is still in a really serious situation now because of that event. And it was a crazy day. Then, you know, we had to then wash down the vehicles, and then the next day we were back out in town fighting again, and I was still finding lumps of flesh and clots and all sorts about 3 weeks after.
Jeez,
and the smell, Christ. You know, the smell was horrendous. That just doesn't go away.
Right.
I opened up the door the next day, and you know what the flies are like when you was in Fallujah. The flies are everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And these flies were just riddled in the back of this vehicle because of the stench and the smell. It was honking, if I'm honest. It was brutal. But we had to go back in that vehicle the next day and do our thing. It was a demand. The tour was
Did
was
you guys very, have anybody that talked to you, like said, hey, what you just saw was horrific, like if you need help or anything like that? Because I remember at our time, like it wasn't that way.
No.
And I think if anything I could have changed about our time, obviously the violence is one, but the results of the violence, like not having somebody there to talk to you and like kind of talk you down and then getting right back on the horse the next day is really insane.
Yeah, well, we were saying no one spoke about it. I mean, everyone just kind of pretended that that event never happened. And
mm-hmm.
We didn't have any trauma risk management people who were educated or done any courses like that. It was just a case of, right, we're back out into town fighting again tomorrow. We never really assessed
anything. Just go be a soldier again.
Yeah, let's go again. And it was just a bit of a mess, really. But I never knew any different. And if I had my time again, then absolutely we need to decompress after some big situations like that, because, you know, that's not normal.
Right.
To see that and to do things like that is not normal. That is a huge traumatic event. And but we just kind of shook it off and was like, okay, well, we go again tomorrow. And we were back out there scrapping. The tour was lively. And I got back, and to be honest, I had my own problems. If I'm blatantly honest, it wasn't all plain sailing. I had a demand in my headspace and with a lot of things I couldn't shake. And my temper was horrendous. I was just a little bit, I was changed. I went there a young boy. I left my son, who was 3 weeks old. I came back and he was 6 months old at this point, and I couldn't understand where the time had gone.
Mm.
I didn't know how to be a father because I'd left when he was such a young baby. And that was a demand for me. And I took that out on my wife. I kind of blamed her for a lot of things that I'd done and that I'd experienced out there for no reason. I wasn't a very nice person. And then, we kind of had to, we had our own challenges in the household. And then a few years later, these fucking crazy allegations were made against us 5 years after the Battle of Danny Boy. And, I was on my commando course to earn my Green Beret in 2009, and I had about 20 missed calls on my phone when I got back from doing one of the commando tests.
Which is always unsettling as shit.
Yeah, well, I knew, because Lucy would never phone me. My wife would never phone me when I'm on courses. She knows I get my head down. And it's an arduous course. I mean, the commando course to earn my Green Beret was nails. It's a hard course. And I knew there was something wrong, but I thought it was one of the kids. So I phoned up and said, that's what's happening. She said, look, I've just had a letter delivered, and I've opened it, and it says that there's now going to be a public inquiry regarding the Battle of Danny Boy and the allegations against you and my fellow soldiers' murder, mutilation, and mistreatment. And I was like, are you joking me? Like, is it definitely my name? And they were like, yeah, it's definitely your name.
And this is after you had already been awarded the Military Cross by the Queen, like herself.
Yeah. No, and the thing is, and this goes to show, I don't really even talk about that anymore, even though it was kind of one of the highest awards for gallantry and valor. I don't kind of, my medal is in my sock drawer, you know, because Winston Churchill once said, a medal shines or a medal glitters, but it also casts a shadow. And one day I'll get it back out. I mean, I wear it on occasions on Remembrance Day, or, you know, if someone asked me to bring them along, and then I'll do that, but they're not on show in my house or anything like that, because there's a lot of history with them. And, you know, in time, I probably will get them back out and be proud of them. I am proud. I mean, that day alone was incredible. I went to Buckingham Palace with my mum and dad and my wife, and, you know, when I went up to the Queen, she pinned my medal on my chest, and she said she rarely gives these medals out for bravery and gallantry, and what you've done is exceptional. When you wear them with pride. And then all of a sudden, I'm now up against the wall with these allegations, and I didn't have any support from our government. I never had any support from the MOD, the Ministry of Defence. I was on my own. I just thought, I have fought for my country. I'll give everything for my country. I was awarded for gallantry for what I did. And then all of a sudden, my back is now against the wall with this, with these allegations all over the press, all over the news. Reporters now wanting to speak to me and my brother. You know, they were just getting hounded, and I didn't have any support.
I can imagine the rage, like the righteous indignation, like that was flowing through your body whenever your wife is telling you what this letter said. You must have just been outside of your mind.
I couldn't believe it. I honestly couldn't believe it. And then I phoned my adjutant up, we were in Germany at this point. So I phoned my adjutant up, that was my regiment, were in Germany. I was in the UK on this course. So I phoned my adjutant up, and he said, yeah, this is right. And we need to speak to you when you get back. And I said, it's an absolute joke. This is the ultimate betrayal. How can this even come out? And I wasn't even prepared for it. You know,
so you had no inclination at all that this was coming? Nothing?
No, not until it came out and it all went out in public. And then that was it. That was the start of a crazy roller coaster. I was writing statements after statements after statements after statements. I was going into London, speaking to solicitors. I was, I was all over the place, if I'm honest. It was, you know, in the news and the press. I was getting phone calls from friends and family asking what they've read in the newspapers. Is it true? Was I a murderer? Was I mutilating people? Was I mistreating? And I was like, what? So I was justifying myself time and time again. And it didn't only affect me, you know, it affected my family. My son was at school, and then all of a sudden his father is now a murderer. How do you deal with that? Because I certainly never knew how to deal with it. But I just had to remain true to myself and my values. I did what I did.
And the change, like the change from MC after your name in every single publication to charges of murder, like the change in public perception of you switched in an instant, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I was battling to clear my name, and I thought, I shouldn't be even battling to clear my name. We've done nothing wrong. We were ambushed. We countered this. You know, we achieved what a lot of people said was unachievable. We did something which was overly heroic, and then all of a sudden now these are innocent farmers who we've taken from the farming field, took them back alive, lined them up against the wall, and then massacred them. I mean, shit like that just doesn't happen. So how has this got traction? Well, I'll tell you why it got traction, because there was a lawyer in the UK who was a very famous lawyer called Phil Shiner. He was gold standard. He was sought after. He was an award winner, and he'd done a lot of good stuff, right? There was a British case which British soldiers were found guilty, and rightly so, because they did breach and conducted war crimes, and they were found guilty of that. But Phil Shiner got to the bottom of it, and it was called a Bar Mitzvah trial, and he got to the bottom of this, and soldiers, British soldiers, were found guilty because sometimes soldiers get it wrong. We're like any other business out there. Sometimes we get it wrong, but 90% we do get it right, and this was not another Bar Mitzvah trial. This was completely different. But because he had so much credibility, what he was doing is he was paying agents in Iraq bungs of money to come up with these allegations, and they just got traction. But the government were like, our government were like, oh my God, he did so well with the Bar Mitzvah. We need to trust him because there could be something here for this. Mm. And I was like, this is shit, because what evidence have they got? Look at all the weapon systems that we recovered from the battlefield, you know, and what they did as well.
And not to mention the initial calls on the radio, like,
yeah, they had all the logbooks. That this was a joke from start to finish, but it ended up being £31 million of taxpayers' money which was spent on this, and 10 years it took for the verdict to come out. But it was a question of my code of honor, and that's what my book, you know, my book is called Double Cross, which is betrayal, and it was a code of honor and a complete betrayal, because that's what it was for me. You know, I've done, and my other soldiers who were with me had done remarkable, to then having to go through this. It just was unfair. But we did go through it. And like Phil Shiner, he had, you know, he had a lot of money, a lot of big reputation, and he done a lot of damage, a lot of damage. Anyway, they, another lawyer company in the UK, a huge lawyer firm, were also involved. They shredded a document, right? They shredded a document that stated they were all militia fighters and the regiment that they were linked to. But they shredded that. And they said in the court that it was human error. Mm. And I was like, it was human error, because if that had been then brought forward, all of this would have been stopped and you wouldn't have been getting your money like you have been. It's all corrupt, man. It was all horrible people, which were just bloodthirsty, shyster lawyers who were just on the hunt for money. But what they were doing, they were ruining people's lives. They were shattering people's careers. They fueled PTSD. They broke up marriages. They done so much damage. And
it's so unbelievable. I was telling my co-host, like, when I was telling about interviewing you, I was like, this story, like the things that I've read, it doesn't even seem, if you wrote a Hollywood script about it, I don't think it would go through, because people would say this is too unrealistic. Like, yeah. what you went through, what you did, what you're recognized for. Because I imagine the Military Cross is a lot like a lot of our higher level valor awards. The investigations in order to get those are pretty intensive as well. They don't just fucking, the Queen doesn't just hand out awards because Brian said that he did a good job.
Exactly. I never even knew they did awards when I was 23 years old. I did it for my brothers on the left and right of me. I didn't even know about awards. That's how naive I was. And then all of a sudden, you know, I was read out for the military cross, and I was like, wow, that's just incredible. But yeah, I mean, it was a secondary battle that I never knew how to deal with and never knew how to fight, because I wasn't educated. I wasn't prepared for it. And it was hard on me and my family.
So but once that, continued. So once the solicitor says that all these charges are false, and I heard the statement, he was very clear in saying these are the root of this is all lies. We spent all this money. What's your emotion whenever you hear that verdict? Is it relief? Is it anger? Is it a little bit of everything all wrapped into one?
Yeah, I think it's everything all wrapped into one. As crazy as this sounds, I would actually like to go for a beer with Phil Schiner and ask him what his motive was, because I think it's greed, and it probably would have been. But, you know, where did it all start going wrong for him? Because he was very good. He wasn't all bad, trust me. He was very, very good at one point. Where did his moral compass start to become a backbearing? That's what I would like to ask him, because I would just like to know that. But he hasn't given us an apology. He hasn't gone down for any sort of
libel or anything,
treason or anything like that. He hasn't gone down for any libel. I mean, he's a clever man. He's put his, he declared himself bankrupt, and like you said, the judge who basically read the verdict and the summary out was, it was reckless speculation, deliberate lies, and and just pure hostility, and it was just unfair.
Did it affect your patriotism, all the charges, and like how long it took for you to get through everything?
No. There's too much history in my family to be bitter with the country. Look, listen, I'm a big believer in lessons learned. You know, I then put pen to paper, and the book done incredibly well. It exceeded my expectations. It went mad in the UK. It went into the Sunday Times bestseller number 3. Michelle Obama was number 1, but I couldn't shift her off the number 1 spot. But you know, I can roll with that. But it really did cause a lot of waves, and even the reviews. Sorry.
You're good.
The reviews have been brilliant. I mean, I've been overwhelmed by everyone's support, and that's what it's all about. And that's why I remain patriotic, because, yes, the government failed and the MOD had a lot of questions that needed to be answered. But sometimes we all make mistakes. And as long as they are rectified and we can then put in statute of limitation, or we can put in new laws which will stop this from happening, it has to, because the soldier is under so much pressure anyway. They're young, men who are in extreme positions, that needs to be taken on board. So when I was in the dock and I was getting cross-examined by people who have got no idea what it's like to be in a battlefield, that frustrated me. Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted a senior officer to stand up and say, let me put this into context, because I was trying to put it into context, but also answering all of these crazy questions that they were asking me. And actually, they stripped me of all my values. They stripped everything one by one. They put my citation that I was written up for the Military Cross, not to congratulate me, but to tear me to pieces. And I just was like, you've got no idea what it's like. You've got no credibility to me. You haven't done a yard in my shoes, but then yet again, you're going to shred me on everything that I've done for this country. You're a joke. And, you know, the bottom line is, it was all, we were all cleared of everything, which I knew anyway. And like I said, I put pen to paper, the book done really well. And also it was optioned straight away to be put into production. Mm-hmm. But I also knew that only 3% of real life narratives go to screen, but mine was commissioned not so long ago. And it's going to be, I can't give too much away because of
who do you want to play you?
I think it's got to be a British actor with due respect.
Cumberbatch, right? It's got to be Cumberbatch.
We'll see.
Because I saw, I called my wife in here earlier before we started interviewing. I was like, look at this fucking dude's hair, man. Like, this is perfect hair.
Not anymore, look.
Yeah, you shaved it all off. You shaved it all off.
But I actually shaved it off because a good friend of mine and a fellow veteran, he stood on an IED in 2012 and lost both legs above the knee. And I've got, he's a close brother to me, and I love him to pieces, and he's had a tough time of it. And then he was diagnosed with cancer not too long ago. He went through chemo. Unfortunately, he wasn't cleared, and now he's gone into the hardest fight of his life today. So he's gone back into hospital today to try and to beat this, but it's on him at the moment, and it's spreading into his spleen. So I wanted to do something for him, so I said, my hair is a big thing to me, and I'm very well known for having my hair. And I said, look, I'll put it on the line. If I can hit my target of £5,000, my hair's coming off. Within 36 hours, I hit my target. But I'm also running 3 marathons in 3 days for Jay, starting this Friday, my first marathon is. So that's the least I can do. For someone who's given everything and had life-changing injuries through his service, that's the least I can do. And he's a brother in arms, and I hope he gets what he deserves and he can beat this.
So if somebody wanted to donate to that cause, I saw that you had a GoFundMe. Where would they find that out?
It's called Running for Jay. So go on to GoFundMe and just put Running for Jay. And the hashtag is Miles for Jay. That's what I'm doing on my social media. So if you want to follow this journey and see me in a pretty bad way in a physical state, then you can follow me on all platforms. It's Brian Wood MC. Or at Brian Wood MC on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And I'll be giving live updates and doing my thing on there.
So one last question for you. What's next for you? As somebody who's gone through both the heroic side and then public scrutiny, now you have a book that has gained a lot of notoriety. Soon there'll be a movie. What impact do you want to have just in the world?
I want to inspire. I'm a big advocate for, one, for mental health, but two, I like to kind of inspire on things can come good. If you keep moving forward, if you keep attacking, if you keep doing the right thing and staying true to your values, it will come good. And this is a little bit about my backstory, and this is how I overcame adversity. And I've been traveling the world at the moment speaking. I went out to New York. I was on then the Queen Mary and Queen Elizabeth II speaking on their famous ships. And I've been into London with big corporate business talking about decision making in extreme situation and circumstances. And I really enjoy that. And it's a little bit of relief for me because I don't talk about what I've been through every day. So when I do, it's a little bit of therapy. So it's great. And, helping educate children, whether it's coaching, whether it's doing some leadership sessions or anything. It's just, I love giving back and I'm a believer and we all should do a little bit more. And so I think another book maybe on the horizon. I think I'm busy, very busy speaking at the moment in a number of different venues. I'm going to be consulting during the movie, the film. which is great. And I'm also going to be doing another project, which will see me go back out to Iraq and Danny Boy.
Wow.
Believe it or not. Yeah.
If you need, for the movie, if you need a fat American who's out of shape and kind of washed up, feel free to give me a call. Brian, thank you so much for joining us and tell us your story. Go get his book. Watch the movie whenever it comes out. Thanks for joining us, man. So many parts of that story that, like, actually reading his book that he left out, we could have gone on forever. But sometimes I feel like as an interviewer, you kind of have to know, like, what the parameters are and, like, how long somebody can actually speak about that. I feel like he could have told stories for hours about what was going on. It is by far the most interesting story that I've heard in the last 5 or 6 years, easily. I was blown away whenever he was telling me what happened to him.
So impressive, the people that we have out there.
Right.
It's crazy.
That's what's crazy to me, because obviously there's movies and there's books, so a lot of people know, but there's so many countless stories that are just never told. So it's great that he was able to share that with our listeners.
Yeah. Thanks.
And one aspect about it is that I think that because we come from a very American perspective, and I know that, like, just from people reaching out on Twitter or Instagram or whatever, we have soldiers constantly who serve in Canada or serve in the UK that listen to the show. Everything that we talk about, we come at it from a very American centralist view, where everything that we talk about, it's usually this American unit did this, this American did that. I had never, just completely honest, even heard of the Battle of Danny Boy until I came across this guy's story. Never. Had you guys?
No, I hadn't heard of it.
Nope, me neither.
3 versus 28 and more showed up reinforcements in a ditch where you are getting out where you can't even see and having to rush. Just an unbelievable story. Crazy part that he didn't even mention, he is the first British soldier since World War II to give his men the command fixed bayonets. He didn't even mention that.
That's wild.
Like, that's how insane his story is. You just heard it for 50-something minutes, and he didn't even mention the part where he had to look his soldiers in the eye and say, fix bayonets.
Crazy.
That, to me, is the most baffling part of his story. You hear what he did, what he went through, then what he went through after, 5 years after he came back, where they're trying to charge him with war crimes and shit like that, that he eventually was cleared of. And he doesn't even talk about the fixed bayonets. Just an unbelievable story all around. I want to thank our good friends at Dave.com for that last segment. If you're like me, you're not always paying attention to your bank account. And the moment that you see that you're going to be overdrawn, it's just a little bit too late. So end up spending $37 on a cup of coffee thanks to the bank fees. Now they're introducing Dave app. Put an end to overdraft fees for good. Dave is the number one budgeting app in America because it saves you overdraft fees, tells you about upcoming bills, and can advance you $75 from your next paycheck with no credit check and no interest. Get the Dave app for just $1 per month. That's $12 a year, which is way less expensive than an overdraft fee, and you never have to pay one ever again. Dave will help you budget for your upcoming expenses, text you for spending too much, and if you need fast cash, advance you $75 in just 90 seconds. Mark Cuban is an investor in the Dave app, and he used to get crushed before he was uber rich, where he doesn't have to worry about that anymore. 3 million people already use the Dave app and save $1,000 a year in overdraft fees. Go to dave.com/ZBT. It really helps the show if you let them know that you heard about them here. So download the Dave app and never pay an overdraft fee again. It's immediately savings. Go now to dave.com/ZBT. Spelled just like it sounds, D-A-V-E, dave.com/ZBT.
The round number 5 comes to us from friend of the program, retired Army Lieutenant General Bob Caslin, who is the newest president of the University of South Carolina, and he has now invited his students to PT with him 14 times. The last invitation was tweeted out this week from his account, where he welcomed students to meet him at 0600 and attached a sheet of the workout with the hashtag PresidentPT, of course. The tweet read, "Tomorrow at Strom at 6 a.m. Nice, he transitioned to civilian time there.
Mm-hmm.
Workout attached, all welcome, even first-timers. Hashtag you of SC excellence." I love this.
Yeah, I think it's nice. He included a little photo of the workout, and it's like 5 little sets of different things, and I thought it was cute.
Yeah, it's a pretty standard Army-type workout, and it works. But I love this because I think when you think school presidents at most universities, there's just these individuals that sit up in their ivory tower, and maybe you know their name. I would venture to say at big state schools, you could probably walk around and ask 100 people who's the president of the school, and most wouldn't even know it. And then he is doing this in such a genuine manner. It's not like, hey, you better be there for PT. It's like, hey, I'm going to be there if you want to join. Yeah. Cool. And it's a great way to kind of get your pulse on what's going on at the school, because I got to imagine in a relaxed setting like this, he gets people to kind of open up, especially if he's done it 14 times. So he shows he's committed to it. And it's not just a one-off like, hey, I'm used to being in the Army. So people probably go multiple times and can really voice their concerns about anything that's going on at the
you
university.
You think he makes them wear glow belts?
Ooh. If it's dark out, I bet you he recommends it, but doesn't require it.
Oh, my God. Camelbacks? All that
hopefully
stuff from your canteen?
I think that he would have his folks out there being hydrated, no doubt about it.
Well, I had a couple issues with some of his workout.
Let's hear it.
Things. 10 Turkish get-ups? Have you seen how hot Turkish men are? I'd rather do a Turkish get-down. Russian twists? Don't they twist enough already in the news that we see on social media platforms? Squats? Yeah, I think I'll do diddly of those, sir. Diddly squats. Decline sit-ups? Yeah, I usually do. 50 mountain climbers? The last time I did that many of those was on spring break in the Himalayas.
Hey-o!
Do you guys think that we should try his workouts? Because if he's going to post them online, we'd try them out.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
Maybe.
I'm into it.
You're here next week, right?
Yeah, I'm here because some of them seem like it seems like a pretty good thing. Set one, you're going to have Stairway to Heaven's 40 push-ups on top. Set two is 10 pull-ups, 10 dips, 15 burpees, 25 decline sit-ups. Set three is 20 kettlebell swings. And then you have Russian get-ups and the aerobic machine that you're going to do, 20 more squats, 50 mountain climbers, 25 Russian twists, 10 T push-ups, and set five is 50 sit-ups. That's a pretty good little workout.
Couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably not me either. No. I'd stick to rucking.
It was fun to say that we would, though. Felt good for a second. I felt good.
It definitely did. All right, let's move in to save rounds, alibis. Kate, we'll start with you.
All right. Follow us on YouTube. Producer Bren's been putting up a lot of our videos, pretty much all of the videos we've ever done, and there's some really good oldies in there too that I really love. So check out the Zero Blog 30 on YouTube. A lot of fun stuff there. I'm seeing a trainer at the gym when this episode comes out Friday. I will be at the gym in the morning early for me. 0800.
Yeah.
So what are you gonna tell the fella or lady that's training you? Like, what are you gonna tell them your goals are?
To be hot. Like, can you make me hot?
Have you already met that person?
Do you guys have a workout that'll change my face? Is that a thing?
Have you met this person?
No, but okay. She seems cool. I like stalked her out online. So I don't know. Maybe I'll get hot. Hopefully, or I'll show up twice and quit.
Hopefully she has some good training background. Because I feel like so many times at these gyms, you could just go to some weekend course and they give you a certificate and it says, okay, you can train people.
Oh,
now.
No. This place, I like looked deep. I was like taking my time, and this place is super legit.
I think that we should always know, unless it's haircuts, Kate does her
due
research very deep.
Oh, fuck yeah. Really, really do. I like found her personal shit. And like,
wow.
Whoa.
Great kids. Really sweet.
Yikes.
Whoa. Anyway, I also, real quick, sending good vibes. I was getting ready to fall asleep last night, and I follow a lot of military stuff on Twitter, and I start seeing this thing, 80 ambulances rushing by, they're calling for blood and nurses and doctors, 80 paratroopers have been seriously hurt. I'm like, oh my God, this is fucking terrible. I'm like Camp Shelby down in Mississippi, and I'm like, holy shit. And all this hearsay, unofficial news started coming out about it that I was like, oh my God. But it turns out nearly 24 paratroopers were injured while conducting a training exercise in Mississippi last night. The troops were jumping from a C-130 when the wind blew them away from the intended drop zone. So several of the 89 paratroopers landed in a large group of pine trees, and some were taken to the hospital. Others had to be rescued after they were tangled in the trees, but no casualties. No one killed, thank God, but some people definitely hurt. So send good vibes their way. Quick recovery.
Good stuff. Guys. I just have two real quick. I was watching Forrest Gump the other night, and I just happened to turn it on at the scene when he's given the speech at the Vietnam protest, and it got me thinking, have we had any major protests like that for the war in Iraq or Afghanistan to that scale?
Hmm. No,
I mean, right?
There's no
maybe, but I don't. Not that I can remember off the top of my head.
So that was going to be my question. Why do you think that those protests happened for Vietnam to that scale, and they haven't happened for the wars that we're currently involved and still involved in?
Because the draft made people care. The draft brought people into it who brought everyone in America into it, essentially, instead of just this small contingent now who volunteers.
Yeah. And I also think protests happen in different ways now. Then you didn't have social media where you can where you can like bombard people constantly and be talking about it. If you were going to get your voice heard, you had to do it in person back in the day.
Interesting. Well, that just made me think. And then the last thing, there was another instance of a veteran who no longer had any family or friends around, and he passed away, and a plea went out on social media about his
tons
funeral.
Of people showed up.
And thousands. Yeah, and it's just such a nice gesture that you see continuously happen for vets without family and friends when all these strangers show up to honor that person and their service. And I think it's amidst all of the chaos in our world right now, it really is a bright spot.
Indeed it is.
Mine is, I want to give a huge, huge shout out. And I normally don't like to get too political, but to Elizabeth Warren, because Jacob Wall, like if you don't know Jacob Wall, he is a huge troll on the internet, right wing troll, conspiracy theory, just a complete psycho that got kicked off of Twitter, deplatformed and shit like that. He has a Marine who is supposed to be very decorated, 24 years old, and a bodybuilder who Elizabeth Warren, Jacob Wall is going to say later today in a press conference, had sex with him after she met him on an online prostitution site. And I just want to say, if Elizabeth Warren is pulling that kind of dick, good on her.
Yeah.
Even though she's married, that is not going to be something that dissuades people. I think people will be like, dang, good for old Elizabeth Warren taking some time away from the trail to get it in the tail.
Yeah.
There you go. This guy, Jacob Wall, he often is like, I have a bombshell news coming out. And he hosts like press conferences in his friends' driveways. And like two reporters show up at the last one, a trash truck interrupted it. And they're like, hold on, we got to take the recycling out. And it's always something he like builds it up as that. And it's never what it seems. So it's happening today, this afternoon, in somebody's driveway in Arlington.
It's his own driveway. Driveway. He has two moves. He did the same thing with Buttigieg, where he said that Buttigieg was involved with some sexual relationships and cheated on his husband, so he broke that news. He broke the news that Senator Harris wasn't actually born in America, so they tried birtherism again on Senator Harris. It's just the same old tropes, but again, if Elizabeth Warren is dicking down this Marine, good on her, sound the retreat.